Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Eminem, Tidal and the Universal Fire. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to be taking a look back through some of the biggest and most interesting music business news stories of the last week. A week when not one, but two government departments intervened in the big Led Zeppelin song theft case.
Yes, given that we're still in the middle of August, it's been a busy week for litigation news and copyright news.
August generally being a quiet month for music industry news.
You would expect so.
People might not know that.
Might not understand the context.
Might not know the struggle of trying to write a music industry newsletter throughout the month of August is not easy.
But this week has been quite easy because there's been quite a few big stories. So yes, this is an update in the ongoing Led Zeppelin song theft court case, which we have talked about before on Setlist.
We have.
And we'll be coming back to because
it's
still going through the motions and we're waiting for another appeal court hearing. They had one hearing and they're having another hearing. So there is another Ninth Circuit appeal court hearing in the US on the Led Zeppelin song theft case. So we don't need to say a great deal more about it for now, except the development this week is that the Department of Justice and the Copyright Office, those are the two government departments you mentioned, have submitted an amicus brief.
I don't think that's not the most important bit, is it?
I don't really know.
I'd say an.
Did I say a?
Yeah.
But I put a glottal stop in, I'm sure. And the glottal stop is as good as an in.
It's not.
I think most linguists would agree with me.
No, they wouldn't.
An amicus brief.
Oh, changing it now, are you?
A friend of the court submission, as it's sometimes called. So
is it?
Basically, the Department of Justice and the Copyright Office of the American government, of Donald Trump's government, have sent a letter into the court saying that they should uphold the earlier court judgment that ruled that Led Zeppelin had not ripped off the earlier work Taurus when they wrote their legendary track, Stairway to Heaven. And the reason why this is of relevance to regular Setlist listeners is that the last edition that we published was the Blurred Line special.
Yep.
When we talked about some of the technicalities of American copyright law that are relevant to these song theft lawsuits.
Mm.
And that's what this letter that the Department of Justice and the Copyright Office have sent to the court is saying, basically confirming that if you are looking at a plagiarism case relating to an old song, a pre-1978 song, then you have to accept the concept that copyright only protects the sheet music version of that original song. So that's something we talked about on last week's set list.
Yeah.
So this letter was confirming that. It was also saying, and almost potentially relevant to the Katy Perry case as well, even though obviously that was not about a really old song.
Yeah.
But it was saying that if what has been copied between two works is the arrangement of a small number of common musical units, as was the case in the Stairway to Heaven litigation, certainly if you just looked at the sheet music, but also the case in the Katy Perry case, then you have to interpret the copyright very narrowly so that the similarity has to be almost identical for there to be infringement. That's what this letter said. So it'll be interesting to see what impact it has on the Stairway to Heaven case when it gets back to the Ninth Circuit. Maybe it may also be cited with the assumed appeal in the Katy Perry case. And it's also relevant to last week's set list, which if you didn't listen to, you should go back and listen to now.
Another one of those copyright updates, although you've just told everyone, do you think they're still listening? You've just told everyone to go and listen to last week's. Is there any point saying this?
You're suggesting that they're not going to come back. Is that what you're thinking?
Well, they might have left this playing while they play the other one.
I said, if they hadn't already listened to last week.
Oh, so some people are still here.
So some people are still
here. Right, if you're still here, or maybe you've come back. Welcome back, if you've come back. Carry on, if you're still here. Anyway, another copyright story update. Since we last did a news update edition of the podcast, obviously we have a bonus edition last week, Spotify, Amazon, Google and Pandora have formally filed their appeal over the US Copyright Royalty Board's recent decision regarding the rates that digital services should pay songwriters and music publishers in the US.
Yeah, we were expecting this because the CRB, after many years of deliberation, put in place a revised compulsory license that covers the mechanical copying of songs in America, specifically regarding what streaming services should pay, as you say, songwriters and publishers when they stream those songs. Among other things, that decision increased the amount of money that streaming services should be paying to songwriters and publishers.
Woo!
So that was the up. Almost immediately, Spotify and some others said they were going to appeal that decision. Spotify has since insisted that it doesn't actually have a problem with the increase in principle, but that it doesn't like some of the other technicalities of the revised compulsory license.
And actually, there's some things that Spotify doesn't have a problem with that the others all do.
Well, exactly. So we've now got the formal appeal that has come in since the last time we did a full edition of Setlist, which takes issue with the process the CRB went through. And then, yes, there were some points where Amazon, Google and Pandora say, oh, we've also got problems with this. And Spotify are like, oh, actually, we're fine with that. Having said that, it's still Spotify that are feeling all the heat from the songwriters and the music publishers on this. Because obviously the music publishers are angry about this, unsurprisingly so.
I mean, if you're saying we haven't got a problem with the rise, we just got a problem with the process you took to get to that rise. Well, the rise is still the thing, isn't it? What's the problem?
Well, you can go and testify for the National Music Publishers Association before the CRB.
Maybe I will.
And I'm sure you will get them that rise. The NMPA, the trade body for music publishers in the US, who are very angry with Spotify and keep saying so, they issued a statement on this, which actually came in too late for me to run in the story in the CMU Daily.
Oh, right.
This didn't go in the CMU Daily because they sent it me too
An
late.
An exclusive.
But well, I'm sure everyone else published it. But they said, this is David Israelite, the boss of the NMPA. Uh-huh. Spotify, Amazon, Google and Pandora have now been forced to admit in court papers how they think songwriters deserve to be paid less. In their lengthy appeal of the 2018 CRB rate increase, which gave music creators a 44% raise, these giant tech companies confirm they are trying to slash the already low rates they pay to songwriters. The service's challenge is unprecedented. The first time a CRB decision has ever been appealed for songwriters. We will continue to fight our win to be upheld and for the digital services to respect and value the work of creators who make their platforms possible, said David Israelite of the NMPA.
Wow.
So that was another big development. This was about 10 days ago, I think, probably 12 days ago by the time people are listening to this podcast. Recently.
Yeah.
This month.
Yeah.
Definitely this month. So two pretty big developments in two pretty big copyright stories, which in any other week we would probably be doing as a full bit on Setlist. But then another much bigger copyright case landed on our desk.
Oh, yeah, and it's a good one.
So that's what we're going to focus on this week. And some other stuff.
Yes, before we get to that, what a such a great, great story. Anyway, before we get to that, that's me teasing it. Can you get excited, everyone?
Everyone's excited.
It's coming up. But before we get to that thing that you should be very excited about, we're actually here to discuss Tidal threatening to sue Norway. That's not even the big exciting stuff.
Well, it's quite funny.
And Universal telling a load of artists who are suing it that they have absolutely no reason to. But first, Eminem's publishing company, 8 Mile Style, has launched a banger of a lawsuit. Not only is it suing Spotify for streaming the rapper's music without first securing the correct licenses, it's also claiming that the recently passed Music Modernization Act is unconstitutional.
Yeah, that's the Music Modernization Act, the reforms of American copyright law, the once-in-a-lifetime reforms, as some people were dubbing it, that was welcomed by the songwriters and the music publishers and the streaming services, both sides of the House and the Senate in Congress, even Donald Trump himself. Everybody said, these reforms are a great idea. We said they were a great idea because they were a great idea, but it turns out, according to Eminem's publishing company, unconstitutional.
Yeah, Eminem's publishing company is annoyed about the Music Modernization Act because it stops people from filing lawsuits like this one that it has just filed.
Hence why it needed an MMA get out halfway through its legal filing. So yeah, this is the latest in a long line of lawsuits against Spotify. I mean, it's not just Spotify who've been sued on this issue, but generally it's Spotify cases that get all the coverage.
Yeah.
And this one, well, it's Eminem's publishing company, so it's getting a lot of coverage because it's Eminem, one of the biggest artists in the world. And although actually it relates to a whole stack of Eminem songs, the lawsuit itself focuses in on Lose Yourself, one of its biggest hits. So one of the biggest musicians in the world, one of the biggest hits in the world, is at the heart of this lawsuit. But basically, in the main, it's another mechanical royalties lawsuit against a streaming service. And obviously there was a period when there was a whole bunch of these being filed. We had a whole special, if you remember, somewhere back in the archives where you weren't here.
I didn't need to be.
And we had music rights expert Becky Brook here. People do still tell me that they found that podcast.
I wish they wouldn't.
To be a particularly good edition of Setlist, although it may not have been called Setlist at that point. Was that pre or after?
I think that was Setlist era.
This podcast had another name.
Yeah, don't talk about it.
In the past. But these mechanical royalty lawsuits are all based on the fact that in America, unlike everywhere else in the world, well, not everywhere else, but most other countries in the world, there isn't a collecting society representing the so-called mechanical rights in songs. Streaming services, when they stream music, are exploiting both the so-called performing rights and mechanical rights in the songs and recordings on their platforms, which means their licenses need to cover both elements of the copyright. But in most countries, there is a collecting society that can provide either a blanket license or what I call a mop-up license for the so-called mechanical rights, as well as the performing rights. So in a lot of continental Europe, it's the same society.
Yeah.
There's one society that does both. In most of the Anglo-American markets and elsewhere, there are probably separate societies. There's one for performing rights and one for mechanical rights. But crucially, there is a collecting society.
Yes.
And what's good about a collecting society is that if you're trying to license songs to your streaming service, they can give you either a blanket license, which is basically everything, more or less. There'll always be some gaps in that license, but pretty much everything. Or in some markets, particularly of Anglo-American repertoire, you will actually have to go and do direct deals with music publishers for a big chunk of the song repertoire. But crucially, there's a society you can go to and say, okay, I've got the direct deals that are out there that are relatively easy to get, and will you now give me a license that covers everything else that may be on our platform? Because we don't know what's on our platform. Because record companies and distributors, DIY artists via their DIY distributors, keep uploading tracks into our system. Tens of thousands a day. We've no idea what songs are in those recordings. So therefore, we have to have a 100% license that covers everything. Otherwise, we'll be liable for copyright infringement. So hey, collecting society, will you help us do that? Either through a blanket license or a mop-up license. And in most countries, that's how it works.
Not America, though.
Not America.
Not at the moment.
For performing rights, yes. Go to BMI and ASCAP and GMR and CSAC. Actually, in the last 18 months, two new performing rights societies have launched in America. So it's kind of getting to the point now where, although in theory there is a collective licensing system that can give you a blanket license for performing rights in America, it could soon be six deals you have to do. And that's
they
only
need an organisation on top of them to do the deal that does the deals.
That does exist in Brazil, where there are six performing rights organisations, and there is an organisation that sits on top of the performing rights organisations.
Sounds like a really good system.
But that's performing rights. Yeah. We're talking about mechanical rights. So in the US, there is no mechanical right collecting society. There is, however, a compulsory license covering mechanical rights.
Well, that's all easy then.
So you know what rate you're going to pay the writer or the publisher or whoever it is who owns the mechanical rights in the song copyright, because this thing called the Copyright Royalty Board sets it. That's what that appeal was about just now. The CRB set a rate, a new rate, a higher rate, and the services didn't like it, and they're appealing it. But crucially, there is a Copyright Royalty Board that does set a rate, even if no one could quite agree on what that rate should be. So what that means is each streaming service doesn't need a bespoke deal with every single songwriter and music publisher in America, because basically the deal is done in the compulsory license. However, in order to rely on that compulsory license, the streaming service has to send the copyright owner, which will probably be a publisher, but it could be a writer if the writer is self-published, a bunch of paperwork, a form, basically, to say, we're going to be exploiting your song copyrights. And then once the form has been sent, they get the copyright owner's bank account details. And then whenever the song is streamed, they pay them at the statutory rate. And that's what is meant to happen.
It sounds so simple.
But, as we've already alluded to, the problem is all this music's being uploaded into Spotify. There was, 30 million tracks when they arrived in the American market. And then thousands and thousands more being added every single day. They don't know what those songs are.
They know what the recordings are.
They know what the recordings are. They know what the recording is called, because it has a title.
Yeah.
That's generally how music works. And also, the label or distributor uploading it will be providing a unique code for the track, the ISRC. So on the recording side, they're pretty certain, okay, we know what the track is, and we're going to assume that whoever uploaded that track to us, they control it, so we should pay them the recording right royalties whenever that track is streamed. But on the song side, they don't even know what the song is. And even if they did know what the song is, they wouldn't know who owns that song and who controls the mechanical rights in that song in the US. Obviously, they do know the track name, and the track name might be Lose Yourself.
It could be, yeah.
For example.
It's been known.
But if you check, as I did, once this lawsuit had been filed, the ISWC database. So the ISWC is the unique identifier for songs.
Yes.
And there's a database of those. So if you go to the ISWC database and you search Lose Yourself, there's more than 100 songs called Lose Yourself. Some of them are in the database more than once, which confused me. But I was trying to discount those when I did the maths.
Yeah.
And I think there's still more than 100, even if you discount the songs, which are weirdly listed twice in the database. So the same song with the same ISWC are in the database twice. Don't understand that. But even allowing for that, more than 100 songs called Lose Yourself. So just because the track is called Lose Yourself, it doesn't mean you know what song is contained within it, because you're not getting this ISWC from the label or distributor. So you don't know what song has been exploited, let alone who controls that song and who you should send the paperwork to and who you should be paying. And because there's so much music on the streaming platforms, and because that's a nightmare, and because nobody has come up with a decent system of doing this, lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of songs which are streaming happily away on Spotify and all the other streaming services, the paperwork has never been sent to the copyright owner. And if the paperwork isn't sent, the compulsory license doesn't apply. That's copyright infringement. And so, if you're the publisher or the songwriter, if you own the mechanical rights in that song, well, this is America, so you sue them.
Yes. Now, I mean, you could say that there are lots of songs called Lose Yourself, but if you go and look and you see it's Lose Yourself by Eminem, you can probably be pretty sure it's Lose Yourself by Eminem. But again, if there's tens of thousands of songs every day coming onto your service, it's all well and good to say, well, my song is obviously my song, but everyone's song is probably obviously their song. Not easy, is it?
It's not easy, although it has to be said in their lawsuit, in this very interesting new lawsuit, filed by 8 Mile Style, they were basically saying, and I suppose to an extent they have a point. I mean, I think we've been quite clear in our reporting on this, both in the CB Daily and on Setlist, that we were basically of the opinion, and you know, a decent portion of the American music community was of this opinion too, that this is a shitty system for administrating, right? It's not really Spotify's fault. It's the music industry's fault. It's copyright law's fault. And we should have a better system for doing all of this. And to an extent, that is what the Music Modernization Act is trying to set up. Although, I suppose, what 8 Mile Style are saying in this lawsuit is, you'd think if there was one song that they could work out and do a little bit of detective work and identify belongs to 8 Mile Style, it would be Eminem. Lose Yourself. And that, and basically that is what they are saying, that it's absurd that, well, what they're saying in the lawsuit is that Spotify and the Harry Fox Agency, which is the rights administration agency that work with Spotify to try and do all of this, working out what songs have been streamed and sending off the paperwork, had actually sent the forms, not to 8 Mile Style, but to the American Copyright Office, which is actually a get out provided by the Copyright Act.
Yes.
That if you can't work out who owns the copyright, or indeed what copyright has been exploited, instead you send the paperwork to the Copyright Office, and then the compulsory license still applies. And I think originally people weren't really doing that, but once the lawsuit started to stack up on this
issue, they really are now.
Loads and loads of these forms are being sent to the Copyright Office. And what 8 Mile Style is saying is that Spotify and Harry Fox had sent the forms for Lose Yourself by Eminem to the Copyright Office, filed as, we can't work out who owns this copyright? And they're basically saying, oh, for God's sake, this is one of the biggest hits of the last 20 years. Surely you could have worked this out. And I guess what they're implying, and I think the other people who have been very critical of Spotify, etc., over this in recent years, will probably feel vindicated, saying that if you can't even do it with the mega hits, then God knows what's happening with the lesser-known music, which a lot of the previous cases on this have tended to be. Well, not necessarily lesser known always, but certainly not a mega hit like Eminem's Lose Yourself.
Yeah, so the spanner in the works for this lawsuit is that as part of the Music Modernization Act, a deal was done whereby the streaming services committed to pay to set up a mechanical rights collecting society that would be able to offer that mop-up license to cover everything that they hadn't otherwise licensed directly.
Like you can get from a collecting society in pretty much every other country in the world.
Yes. And that collecting society is now being set up. But in return for handing over that money to pay for the setting up of this new collecting society, which is now happening, in return there'd be a change of the law which would stop any copyright owners whose music had been streamed without a license from pursuing statutory damages. And that's a flat rate amount of damages regardless of any actual losses. It's just a flat fee you have to pay, which is why some of these lawsuits that were filed in the past could stretch into billions of damages, because once you pile up all the statutory amounts available for each infringement, it's quite a lot.
Yeah, the statutory damages element of American copyright law, which is, I mean, it's not unique to American copyright law, but it's quite unusual. This idea that if your music has been streamed without license, as in this case, rather than suing for what you have lost as a result of that, which is what you would probably do here in the UK, So you would say, well, had I been paid my royalties, I would have earned £1,000. So I want my £1,000.
Which in theory, the streaming services were all putting that money aside.
Yeah, because they knew.
So they would have just said, well, here it is. We were trying to give it to you.
The streaming service should have known they owed you a grand. Yeah. Yes, as you say, they should be sitting on that money somewhere. Whereas the statute of damages, basically it's a rate card, it's a menu, and you can go, and if you can prove that the infringement was willful, the word is, that they use, then it can be up to 150 grand per infringement. So if you've got 250 songs sitting on Spotify, each of which have been streamed at least once, and if they have only been streamed once, then you would be due cents worth of royalties, you could still sue for 250 times 150 grand. So obviously, that created an incentive almost for those publishers and writers whose work had been streamed without license. Rather than going to Spotify and saying, hey, hang on a second, that's my song, these ISRCs or my ISWCs, I've done the maths, I reckon I'm owed a few grand, where's my money, here's my bank details. There's an incentive to not do that. Hire a lawyer and sue for statutory damages. And so, yeah, there was a quid pro quo in the Music Modernisation Act, which basically was, okay, the issue here is that we don't have a collecting society that offers a mop-up licence that takes responsibility for paying the writers like we have in most other countries. So we need to set one of those up. Sounds quite expensive, setting one of those up. But how about Spotify and all the other streaming services pay for that? Then the publishers can set that up and have that running. Hopefully that will solve the problem. I mean, it probably won't solve the problem. All it means is that there will now be a bank account into which the money can be paid. Whether or not that society will then work out who is owed the money and pay it is another story. But from the streaming services perspective, as you say, the crucial point was that in return, what the Music Modernisation Act said is that from the 1st of January 2018, so even before the MMA came into law, the owners of song copyrights were banned from pursuing statutory damages through the courts for the unlicensed streaming of their songs, even if it happened, well, obviously it's happened pre this collecting society because this collecting society hasn't been set up yet.
I mean,
as you say, it's being set up, but it doesn't exist yet. So this mop-up license doesn't exist yet. But what the MMA did was it said, okay, 1st of Jan 2018, we are saying no more lawsuits pursuing statutory damages on this point. We're calling this off completely, which is why Wixon filed, that was the multi-billion dollar one, like 2 days before that deadline. And we're basically saying we wouldn't have sued at this stage, except that we need to get it in before this deadline. They ultimately settled. But I suppose the key point of all of this is that what the MMA means, in theory, is even if 8 Mile Style are right, that Spotify and HFA are inept to have not worked out that a track called Eminem Lose Yourself is the Eminem version of Lose Yourself.
Possibly
and
fair.
And that 8 Mile Style is the publisher of that. Under the MMA, they shouldn't be allowed to sue for statutory damages because the 1st of January 2018 has definitely passed.
Yes, and so they can only sue for what they should have been paid. They don't really need a lawyer for that. They can just go and ask for it.
They might as well just go and ask for it rather than going to all of the cost of pursuing litigation.
And that is what 8 Mile Style thinks is unconstitutional because they want the statutory damages. They don't want just what they're owed.
So yeah, 8 Mile Style acknowledge that this is an issue with their lawsuit. In some ways, they're late to the party and technically too late to the party. Although they make 2 points. First of all, they say, well, yes, the MMA draws this line in the sand. It says 1st of January 2018, you can't sue for statutory damages after that date. But it says the next bit of the MMA then puts a bunch of obligations on the streaming services and says the streaming services need to fulfill all of these obligations in order for this limitation on the right of the copyright owner to sue to kick in. And so they're arguing at length that Spotify hasn't met those obligations. But then, after presenting all of those arguments, they then say, but on the off chance that the District Court of Tennessee in Nashville doesn't agree with us that Spotify hasn't met these obligations, that entire bit of Music Modernisation Act is unconstitutional anyway.
Yes, it says, the retroactive elimination of the right of a successful plaintiff to receive profits attributable to the infringement, statutory damages and attorney's fees is an unconstitutional denial of substantive and procedural due process in an unconstitutional taking of a vested property right. I mean, that means something. Those are definitely words.
Those are definitely legal-sounding words. So this is an incredibly interesting case, A, because it's another mechanical royalties multi-million dollar lawsuit, even though we were not meant to be getting any more of those. Also, obviously, because it involves such a big artist and such big songs. It's also interesting, in the lawsuit, 8 Mile Style are quite critical of the aforementioned National Music Publishers Association.
Yes.
Which, A, agreed a settlement deal with Spotify over unpaid mechanicals, which a whole load of publishers then were part of that settlement. This is like a few years ago now. And then B, collaborated with Spotify and the other streaming services to get the Music Modernization Act agreed and through Congress. And they are basically saying that the NMPA, although it represents any music publisher in America, is welcome to be a member of the NMPA, but they're saying, oh, well, it's dominated by the majors. And at that point, the majors all had equity in Spotify, sometimes through the record company bit,
yeah.
But nevertheless, it is true that they did have equity in Spotify, so they were biased, and that was a terrible settlement, and the MMA should never have gone the way that it did. Although, of course, I mean, the interesting thing is, on this, that Spotify might want to go to the NMPA, its collaborator on the Music Modernization Act, so they can go to court and say, look, we all agreed on this, the publishers, the songwriters, and the streaming services, we all agreed that this was the right way forward. How can it be unconstitutional? Hey, publishers, speak up in our defense. But as we've just discussed, because of the appeal of the CRB ruling on the rates that should be paid under the compulsory license, there is currently no love lost between the NMPA and Spotify. I don't think David Israelite's going to be rocking up at the court in Nashville to
these guys are great
to speak in Spotify's defense. So, a very interesting lawsuit on very many levels.
Still to come, a Universal Fire update. But forget that for a moment, because Tidal is suing Norway.
The whole country of Norway. Anyone listening in Norway, consider yourself sued by Jay-Z and Tidal. Currently, it's a threat.
Yeah.
It hasn't actually...
Still quite a threat.
Hasn't happened yet. This all relates to something which I'm sure we talked about on Setlist. I didn't actually go back through the archive to check. This could have happened in a week when we weren't doing a podcast. I'm pretty sure we talked about it, though.
I think we have.
It's the stats fiddling allegations. So it was alleged in a Norwegian business newspaper. Tidal is always big news in Norway because originally it was a Norwegian company.
Yes.
Still is in many ways. Obviously, ultimately now owned by Jay-Z in America. But originally it was a Nordic streaming service with its big base in Norway. So the Norway press have been very interested in Tidal since the Jay-Z acquisition. And it was a Norwegian newspaper that alleged that when Tidal had its exclusives with a Beyoncé and a Kanye record, that it fiddled the figures to make it look like many more people were streaming those albums when they were released than really had been, is the allegation.
Yeah, and that, I mean, fiddling the figures in music is not a new thing. As long as there have been numbers that could be fiddled in music, there has been fiddling of those numbers.
And if you're a streaming service who are really pushing the idea that artists should give certain albums exclusively to one streaming service, to a relatively small streaming service, cutting out the market-leading streaming services in order to do that, you could see, I mean, we should stress that Tidal deny all of this,
but yep,
you could see why that service might want to hype up how successful those exclusives have been and how many people were tuning in order to encourage other people into thinking maybe that's the right decision.
The problem with streaming, though, is that unlike other sorts of music industry number fiddling, there is a direct financial implication for other artists on the service because all the money's divided up on your percentage of listening. And so if one artist has their listening figures boosted, then the others all have to have theirs shrunk.
Which is why once this Norwegian newspaper had reported on this, and there were various ways in which it felt pretty confident about these allegations, although we should stress again that Tidal throughout have denied all of these allegations and have been very disparaging about this Norwegian newspaper.
Yeah, they say the newspaper has some sort of vendetta against them and is making stuff up.
Although, I mean, it is a business newspaper in Norway. I mean, it's not the Norwegian version of The Sun.
No.
It is quite a credible newspaper. And indeed, the indie labels gave the journalist who broke the story an award, didn't
yeah.
they? For saying, well done for doing some serious investigative journalism. Because the consensus is, yeah, that if you skew the figures because of the way streaming royalties are calculated on a consumption share basis, if you're saying that Beyoncé and Kanye had much bigger consumption share than they really did, more of the royalties will go to those two artists and their labels and publishers, to the detriment of other artists. And I suppose the feeling was that indie labels and sort of self-published songwriters would probably be the biggest losers there. So after that story had broken, it was the Norwegian Collecting Society, the Norwegian version of PRS, that called on the country's government, or specifically what's dubbed as an economic crime agency.
Økokrim, which is, that's a great name.
Perfect pronunciation by Andy there, I'm sure. They called on that agency to investigate the allegations made in this newspaper. And all of that began, the revelations were last year, weren't they?
Yeah.
Sort of around May last year. But it was confirmed earlier this year, but very early this year, that indeed that Norwegian agency was investigating these alleged, well, it's fraud, basically, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously, that's a very serious charge. So understandably, Tidal are fighting it, and they're quite upset about it, as well as being quite disparaging of this newspaper and its reporting. They've also said in their legal threat, which is coming through Tidal Poland.
More on which in a moment.
They've said in this legal threat that this crime agency's investigation is inadequately justified and aggressive and violates an investment treaty that exists between Poland and Norway. There's your technicality.
Here's the international element. So yeah, this is all a bit weird. It's actually a legal letter that was sent by lawyers working for Tidal back in April, I think, but it's just come to everyone's attention now. And yeah, this is complicated. So Tidal has bases in various countries around the world. So the US, obviously, since the Jay-Z acquisition, but a number of North European countries as well, including Poland. And so the complaint is actually coming from Tidal Poland on the basis that Norway and Poland have this investment treaty about which we know very little. I mean, we could have done some research there, I
could
guess.
Have done.
And presumably it exists, but probably not in English.
Yeah.
There's our excuse. And we didn't think Google Translate was up to the job.
It really is.
And so on the basis of this treaty, they are saying there is a case against this crime agency in Norway because they're claiming that by pursuing this investigation in the way that it has, it is violating this treaty and it is calling on the Norwegian government and this agency to come to the table and to negotiate some sort of settlement about this investigation. And if they don't, well, what do you do if it's international law?
Well, of course, you go to the Ad Hoc International Arbitration Tribunal. That's where I always go.
That's what the lawyers are threatening in this letter. They also mentioned that they potentially could pursue it through the courts in Norway itself. So we don't really know what any of that means because, I mean, we should clarify, we're not experts on international treaties between Poland and Norway.
It's not a field of expertise.
I did a whole law degree. It never came up.
Yeah.
Imagine that. So I don't really know how credible that claim is.
Still, threatening to sue. I mean, it's the first time I'm aware of that a streaming service has threatened to sue an entire country. And I think it should happen more often because I like it.
So quite a bold move on Tidal's part to try and kill that controversy around the alleged fiddling of figures. So we will see what happens next. But yeah, I'd like to see this in court.
Yeah.
I think Jay-Z taking on the entire population of Norway, that would be a very fun thing to cover.
We're rapidly running out of time, but we very briefly got a moment for you to do some plugging.
Yeah, we haven't.
And
really,
now you already told me that you've got a lot of stuff to plug. So
we haven't really
knock through it.
Sorry, done a lot of plugging.
I'll stop interrupting you now.
You should.
Get on with it.
Otherwise, this will last forever.
It will, won't it?
We haven't had a plugging section on
we
set
haven't.
List for a while now because in the summer nothing happens. But September's coming up.
Mm.
Back to school.
Ooh.
And so lots of things happening in September, and I should mention some of them now. The first is podcast relevant.
Is it?
There's a festival of podcasts happening at King's Place in London in September. And as part of that, there's the Podcast Maker Weekend, which is a weekend of sessions on making podcasts.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of very good sessions there, which I think we should probably go to. I mean, things like technical stuff about how to make your podcast better, how to monetize your podcast. We definitely need to work out that, don't we? So loads of great sessions over that weekend. But one of them is looking at using music in podcasts. So it's called Music and Podcasting, nice and straightforward. And
yep.
I'm going to be taking part in that. So I am currently, as we speak, researching the ins and outs of licensing music for podcasts.
Right, I mean, well, you can't. So that's a quick sub. It's not going to last long, this talk, is it?
There is more to it than that.
Yeah.
Although it is very hard to get a radio-style blanket license for music in podcasts. So anyway, I'm going to be talking about the ins and outs of getting music into your podcasts, both from a licensing perspective, but also from a PR perspective. So that is happening on the 15th of September, Sunday morning. So you have to be really keen and get up. But should be a really interesting session. It's not just me, other people taking part as well. So definitely check that out. As with all of these things, we'll put some links in the notes to where you can get your tickets.
Sure.
For all of these things. I've got some conferences coming up in September. So the Reeperbahn Festival is taking place in Hamburg and we will be there. We're involved in 3 panels this year, 2 on the whole song royalty thing, which we talked about a lot at The Great Escape back in May. And we've got 2 very interesting panels on that. And then we'll also be putting the spotlight on marketing and how album campaigns are changing. So if you're at Reeperbahn, do check out our sessions. Pivotal is returning in Birmingham at the end of September. And we've got CMU House there.
That's fair. A whole house.
A whole venue
to ourselves.
How many bedrooms? I've not checked how many bedrooms there are. All en suite, I would hope.
Mm.
So we're going to be putting the spotlight on our pathways.
Well, no, that's wasteful.
I mean, that's not a good use.
We don't need all of them en suite.
We're going to be looking at our pathways into music project, looking at music careers and music education in the morning. And then we're going to be looking at our fan data guide, the one we compiled for the Music Managers Forum, and other data stuff and fan data stuff and fan base building stuff in the afternoon. In addition to all of that, the Artist Entrepreneur Day that we present with the Featured Artist Coalition is also happening as part of Pivotal with AWOL. So you can pick, you can go to CMU House, or you can go to the AWOL FAC House and join CMU DIY for the Artist Entrepreneur Day. So that's Pivotal happening in Birmingham. And on top of all of that, we've got the CMU seminars coming back. The copyright seminars are all happening throughout September. So book your tickets for that, and I will explain to you how music copyright and music rights work. If you're in Dublin, the MMF, Mechanics of Music Management course that we run for the Music Managers Forum here in London, we're doing some versions in Dublin with IMRO, the society over there. The first of those is on the 25th of September. And I'm doing a session with the Musicians Union day before Pivotal in Birmingham. So if you're an MU member in the Midlands, we'll be talking about all digital stuff and copyright and digital dollars, etc., for MU members in Birmingham. It's a very busy month.
You said there was a lot. That was a lot.
So you will put links to all of those in the
notes. I will. If you go to setlistpodcast.com and find the show notes for this episode, which will be right at the top, so it'll be very easy, and you will find links for more information and tickets for all of those in there. And finally, we return once again to the Universal Archive Fire lawsuit. At the beginning of last week, there was an update in that Hole dropped out of that lawsuit. It's a class action lawsuit, but there were various artists named on it as plaintiffs. Hole were one of them. They've dropped out because they have accepted that Universal has found all their masters and they're definitely not destroyed in a fire. Then later in the week, Universal submitted another document to court saying that it had now worked out that three of the four remaining artists on that list, so that is Steve Earle and the estates of Tom Petty and Tupac Shakur, also had nothing, well, not nothing lost in the fire, but no masters, except one generic master in the case of Tupac, but it had another copy. But it's basically saying stuff was lost, but there's copies of everything and no masters were lost that cannot be replaced.
Now, this class action relating to the 2008 fire at the Universal Studios complex in Hollywood, we definitely talked about the fire at some length.
Yes.
On a previous edition of Setlist. The reason why we're talking about this in 2019, when the fire was in 2008, is because the New York Times recently ran a couple of articles basically saying that back in 2008, Universal Music told everybody, yes, there was a fire at the Universal Film Studios in Hollywood. Yes, because we used to be part of the same company as Universal Studios. We had a warehouse there that had some stuff in it that burnt down, but very little was actually damaged. We'd moved most of the master recordings out of there anyway. Nobody should be worrying about this. Whereas this New York Times article that we discussed on a previous edition of Setlist was saying, aha, actually, loads of tapes were there and loads of tapes were destroyed. Lots of artists have now lost their masters.
They listed it they initially said hundreds, but then in a separate article, they published a whole list of 800 artists they reckoned could have been affected by this fire.
So they were basically saying massive cover-up at Universal, loads of artists affected, and even to this day, Universal have never properly told most of these artists that their masters don't exist and why their masters don't exist. And so that became quite a big news story for a while. Universal then were putting out statements saying New York Times are exaggerating. It was nowhere near as big as they are saying, although kind of conceding that it was probably a bigger deal than they had originally admitted in 2008, but not as big a deal as the New York Times were claiming in 2019. They also set up a team of people to get in touch with the artists who were potentially affected back in 2008 by the fire, and they started reaching out to those people. And then they kept putting out statements, both internally and externally, about how they'd found most of these recordings or other copies of these recordings. But it was pretty clear early on, I mean, this is America, that as soon as this story went viral, there was going to be litigation. And yeah, to date, I think there's just the one class action. Or am I right in saying that?
I believe so.
And that is obviously It's a class action, so ultimately open to any artists whose masters may have been lost in the fire, although, as you say, it specifically had some lead plaintiffs who were named.
Yes.
Which included Hole and the estates of Tupacicourt, Tom Petty, etc. And I suppose the core allegation in that lawsuit was that back in 2008, Universal got an insurance payout after the fire.
Yeah.
And also reached a financial settlement with Universal Studios, because by this point they were separate companies.
Yeah.
And so they said Universal Studios hadn't done enough to ensure a fire didn't happen. So they got damages off Universal Studios. And so this lawsuit was basically saying that should have been shared with the affected artists. Instead, the affected artists weren't even told that their masters had been lost. And so this class action is trying to get a cut of that money. Universal initially presented a whole load of legal arguments as to why the lawsuit was flawed. But as you say, more recently, beyond the legal arguments, has started picking off the artists who were named on the lawsuit, basically saying, well, even though we don't accept any of your legal arguments, more than that, the artists who you claim to be representing didn't lose any masters anyway.
Yes. So as we said, Hole dropped out already. The Universal is now saying Steve Earle, Tom Petty, Tupac Shakur didn't really lose anything, so they shouldn't be part of this class action anymore. Soundgarden are the only named artists left, and the only reason they're still there is because Universal hasn't finished investigating what's happened to their masters, and presumably it's expecting to come back and say they've lost nothing as well. But we'll see what happens with that.
And then that would require, I guess, the lawyers who are leading on this case to go down that list of hundreds and hundreds of artists published by the New York Times and desperately try and find some where there definitely was some loss.
Yes, and well, that's one of the... Universal's been putting out increasingly tetchy, both legal filings and public statements about this lawsuit. One of which, in the legal filing, was that the lawyers leading on this lawsuit, as they come back and say, look, we haven't lost anything, it's all fine, we've got it all, rather than backing down and saying, okay, we'll drop the lawsuit, is just coming back with more and more artists, some of whom are not part of the class, according to Universal, and they think that these lawyers are just kind of, they've smelt money, and so they're just desperately trying to find some artist who is affected so that they can carry on with this lawsuit and make that money.
Yeah, they're fishing for work, and so yeah, the allegation is that they didn't do the appropriate homework before filing the litigation. All of this backwards and forwards should have happened before they actually went legal. And yeah, you're right, Universal statements are getting increasingly narky as the weeks go on, although the lawyers on the other side are also putting out some quite bold statements.
Quite sarcastic. So Universal's most recent statement at this stage as we record is, the plaintiff's attorneys have already been informed that the original masters for virtually every artist named in their meritless lawsuit are safe in our storage facilities or theirs. The fact that they still pursue legal action and even try to drum up additional bogus claims makes clear that their true motivation is something other than concern for artist masters.
So that's just the latest statement from Universal. There were earlier statements saying similar things.
Yes, in which they called the claims baseless rather than meritless in the previous statement.
Thesaurus out.
But in response to that, in response to being called baseless, one of the attorneys on the artist side, Ed McPherson, put out a statement saying, well, isn't this great? After 11 years of assuring artists that basically nothing was lost in the fire, UMG is actually conducting an investigation to what was lost in the fire. He also took issue with another thing that Universal has said in that previous statement. They basically said, look, we're giving you all the information. We're being fully transparent with you on this, and you should just accept that we haven't lost anything. He then said, if you're being fully transparent, why are you giving us redacted documents in a lot of these cases?
So lots of back and forth between Universal and the lawyers working on this class action, and we suspect more will be forthcoming. But if they do find the Soundgarden recordings, and assuming that the Tupac estate and Tom Petty estate, etc., accept Universal's statement that they have all of their recordings, then the question is, well, a class action has to have at least one lead plaintiff named.
Yeah.
Usually. So presumably they would have to work their way through that list and try and find somebody else to try and keep the case going, which, of course, Universal is already trying to get dismissed on legal grounds, as well as these arguments that all the artists you're mentioning weren't affected.
Yes, so as you say, it remains to be seen how this case continues. For now, it is continuing. But, yeah, well, you know, they've got a list of 800
yes.
to choose from. So they might just work their way down that list.
Are there going to be 800 statements from Universal?
I hope so.
They're going to be putting that thesaurus to good use. What if we have baseless, meritless,
what else?
Worthless,
yeah.
Insane.
I think it's going to just end up as fucking stupid.
Outrageous. Yeah. Be interesting to see
how quickly into the 800s will Universal start swearing.
Well, we look forward to finding out.
Yes, but that is all we've got time for this week. If you have any questions or comments about things we've talked about this week, email us setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk, or you can find us on social media, where usually we are Setlist Pod. But yes, that's all for now. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.